Hello and welcome to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24 with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting US musician Jessica Hoop, whose new album, Stone Child, channels the turbulent times we're all living in.
We'll also be talking to Canadian artist Brian Eugen about his new show, Friendship Center.
And we'll be meeting academics Auriel Sullivan and Jonathan Gershuni, whose new book, What We Really Do All Day, looks to explain, well, exactly that.
All that, plus Monaco's Malcolm Cherchoglian will be looking ahead to some of next week's news as well, right here on the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. Hello, Og. Good to have you back after your stint in New York. How was it?
Yeah, it was really nice, Faye. I had a lovely couple of weeks there in the Big Apple.
Do you enjoy the Big Apple? Because I'm very curious. I've just been once and very quickly.
Yeah, I don't mind taking a bite or two out of the Big Apple.
Would you live there?
Yeah, maybe. One day. You know, not forever, though. A bit of a nightmare getting back, you know. Got bumped from my flight. Has that ever happened to you?
Never happened.
Never happened.
Thankfully. One day they kind of offered me, but then everything was sorted in the end. I was lucky in that way.
Yeah, well, you know, they do offer compensation. So if the opportunity comes up.
And you came back for the heat wave as well, which is good.
Balmy.
I mean, in a way, because, I mean, the Monaco team, they're in Madrid for the conference. Apparently temperatures will reach 40 degrees there.
Too hot there. Who do you think is going to faint first?
Oh, God, perhaps Tom Edwards?
Yeah. He's got a very English complexion, hasn't he? Anyway, with all that said, maybe we should look ahead to what's coming up next week.
I'm very curious, and we have Malcolm Cherchoglian to tell us. Mel, welcome here to the studio. I mean, what's happening next week? I'm very curious.
What isn't happening next week?
Exactly.
The Quality of Life Conference. Yes, exactly. It's over. I've got a real mix of news here. So first of all, Russia's Vladimir Putin is going to Italy for a state visit. He'll be there on Thursday and Friday. And on the first day, he will meet the Pope. This is the third time he'll have met Pope Francis. And this potentially heralds a huge thaw in relationships between the Catholic Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, which has been in a very famous schism for about 1,000 years. And Putin has been, over the course of his 20-odd years in office, been trying to use religion as a way of creating a homogenous Russian culture. Now, of course, Pope Francis represents a very different sort of ideology, but nonetheless is the same sort of tool for keeping people in place, for creating this sort of homogenous culture, which he thinks is integral to a united Russia.
And do we have a sense of how they get on? If they've met twice before already, there's that famous photo of Pope Francis meeting Donald Trump, isn't there? He's got a face like thunder. What expressions is he going to pull for Putin?
Well, I think they get along quite well because Vladimir Putin is more devout than right. Trump, as I understand, and he technically leads a more devout country, one can say. So I guess Pope Francis doesn't really care about his temporal sins as long as spiritually he is a child of Christ. And also, Pope Francis famously in 2016 met the Russian Patriarch Kirill, the first time the Russian Patriarch and the Pope have ever met. So this is one of several steps, I believe, to a closer proximity between the two churches.
Where are you taking next, Mel?
Well, to Sotheby's down the road on
Perfect.
New Bond Street. In 1831, a series of chess pieces called the Lewis chess pieces were discovered on an island in the UK. And another one has been discovered. How amazing. Well, rather, it had been purchased for £5 by someone in Edinburgh. It's been passed down through the family, and now it is in Sotheby's. One piece that people didn't even know exist, while the others are in the hands of the British Museum and the National Museum of Scotland, I believe. This one will be the first that can actually go into private hands, and the estimated price is £600,000 to £1 million.
The lost piece. I feel like I read about this. Wasn't it hidden in somewhere very unlikely? I feel like it was even in a bedside table or something like that. Or am I just mixing my recently discovered antiques all up into one bundle?
I think you're embellishing the story with something you'd like it to be. Yeah. But has anyone ever found a piece of treasure in their house?
I found old magazines that are quite valuable. If you
treasure
think about
to Fernando.
It. Yeah. Hey. only to me.
Issue one of Monocle.
Exactly.
I
have
you,
it.
Bob. Yeah.
It's worth quite a lot, actually.
Well, in 200 years, someone will be paying £1 million for it.
Yeah.
Good. What's next, Mel?
And the last thing is Tuesday, World UFO Day.
Ah.
Who believes in aliens?
I do.
You do?
I'm pretty sure.
Fernando has a really serious face. The mood's really changed in the studio.
Absolutely. I mean, of course they exist. What's your view on UFOs, man?
No, I think they exist. But before this, I was reading about the famous Fermi paradox, which is really a paradox, but it says, you know, if there are so many planets and stars, etc., out there in the observable universe, why isn't there another intelligent life form? Some further digging suggests that there might be a great filter, a barrier to all civilizations that we could be in the process of hitting. So all civilizations come to some sort of point and bam, they go extinct. And that could potentially be ahead of us.
So in fact, there might have been great civilizations in the deep past of deep space.
Exactly, but never advanced enough to be able to communicate.
A famous ufologist, Robbie Williams.
No.
From Take That.
Really?
Is he?
Do you know,
well,
you didn't know about
that? A serious ufologist.
He is really into it. He went through a phase where he went a bit mad and moved out into the desert in Arizona. Spent months and months just staring into the sky, growing a long beard.
Wow.
I think we should do that on Tuesday at least, right?
Should we do that?
Yeah.
Stop shaving in anticipation of Tuesday.
Arizona.
Exactly.
Very well, good story.
Well, Mel, is that our lot this week?
That's all from me.
What a generous helping. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Jessica Hoop. Stay with us.
Manchester-based California musician Jessica Hoop has been creating Americana-inflected, inquisitive records for over a decade. She returned this month with new album Stone Child, which tackles themes ranging from discrimination occurring in her home nation to tax effects on the young. Augustine met with Jessica earlier to talk about the new songs.
Come shut in, boys. For the girlfriend experience, enter the code and I'll taste real.
Jessica Hoop, thank you so much for joining me to talk about your new album, Stone Child, and hopefully about much more as well. First of all, congratulations on the album. It's really fantastic.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me in.
It's a great pleasure. I read you say that you have a kind of identity crisis with every new catalogue of songs that you produce, and I wondered first and foremost what Stone Child taught you about your own identity.
Oh, well, I guess probably that I'm never here or there, but just always somewhere in the middle. Stone Child is a lot about transience. There's a thread of transience that runs through it and out of it, and goodbye, there it went. There's a lot of letting go of people, places, things, thoughts, attitudes, etc., but really people. But that's a big one. I have to let go of people quite a lot. That's a very good question. I had never considered what it taught me. You know what it taught me? It taught me I can write songs. Even if I'm really nervous about getting in, say I don't have any songs at the start, if I sit down or if I go for a walk and I spend enough time at it, song structuring is something I know how to do. Song melody and conveying a thought is something that I trust I can do. And it comes with doubt, but the doubt is just that entry point. It's that measuring stick that you put yourself up against.
I'm interested in the idea of transience on the album. You've had quite a unconventional, well, I mean, what is convention? You've lived a life up to this point, and will continue to live it. But it's taken you from the States, it's brought you over to the UK, and I know that this is the first album that you've recorded here, I think. Normally you go back to America record them. And I wondered, you know, in terms of that kind of transience, and in terms as well of your sort of connection to a folkier music, how that shaped your songwriting, how connected you feel to American folk, how connected you feel to English folk, which is very different, and how you kind of mediate between the two?
Well, they're related, and you can hear, all folk is related, but you can hear some of the old Gaelic, Celtic, British sensibilities when you listen to, say, music from the Ozarks. You can hear it in Americana music. I very much approached this like I wanted to strip other influences away and concentrate on folk singing. And there's particular songs that highlight that. The song that's called Footfall to the Path, for instance, I put myself in this setting where perhaps I'm in a field, there's just a microphone out in the field, or on a mountain top.
As every hand I've ever held, like water moves from
think there's a certain kind of storytelling that rings more resonant when you strip away these other influences. I mean, I've carried around a lot of different genre type influences, but I just wanted to hone in more on folk this time to convey thoughts.
Pair it back. And there's also like a lovely wildness to folk music that I think is shared between the English and the kind of American traditions.
There's a way of stepping aside from yourself within this genre of old country or old folk music, where if you like imagine what they're wearing, the singing sounds a bit like that, like rough fabrics, burlap, you know. But the spirited type of singing rather than necessarily refined.
Exactly,
and I'm not sure I'm accomplishing that necessarily, but that is, it's an ingredient in what I'm producing.
I'm interested to hear you talk about the kind of the burlap texture, because I was wondering about, you know, beyond music, what kind of influences you draw on from the arts or from the world to put into songs. And so to hear you talk about something visual and textural, you know, I think that kind of resonates with this question a bit. Do you look at art? Do you put artworks from other media? Do you combine those into, as an influence into what you produce?
I experience them that way. With music, my senses will cross. I will write music from my senses. So there'll be an experience of smell, or a smell has a color. I don't necessarily see music in terms of color, but I hear it in terms of a smell, and the smell has a... I hate that word smell, by the way. It's one of the worst words on the planet.
It's better than odor.
Scent.
Is it better than odor?
Odor is... No, smell is worse.
Smell is worse.
Yeah. But it has a scent, and the scent has a color, and the color has a physical feeling. So these things play a part of it. And in the same exact way, yes, cooking. I'm always bringing cooking into music and landscapes. Landscapes are, a song has a landscape, it has a natural landscape, and you can see it very clearly if you're listening in that way.
Yeah, so with the landscape, I mean, I guess that's one of the, that's the kind of key, that's a key thing that I was wondering about, the difference between the States and the UK to record in and to write music in, especially Bristol, where you recorded this album, which has a landscape quite unlike anywhere else, I think. That kind of rolling Wiltshire sort of, it's old. It feels very old.
It reminds me of San Francisco, actually, strangely. It has a similar feeling. Much more, you probably won't know what I mean by this, but English.
Yeah, I can
as compared to the Californian rolling hills. But there's a similarity in its roughness.
Yeah.
But then also, and in the way that it rolls along.
Yeah. And you were recording there with John Parrish.
That's right.
Who is a longtime collaborator of PJ Harvey.
That's right.
And who was very uncompromising, I've read, in his editing.
Is. Oh, he is. Yes. I always thought you were talking about Polly. Yeah, I think he's even self-proclaimed. I think I won't use the words he used, but when he knows he doesn't want something on there, he's going to put his foot down. And in my position, I think there were a couple moments where that was hard for me, because I'm like, but this was my work and this was my, these were my ideas. And, you know, he would call it, that's what they call killing your darlings. There were moments where he would take something I was attached to on the song. I thought that was making the song. And he's saying, this song is strong. It doesn't need that. And I'm more focused on the song now without it. And I come to a producer to hear things through their ears and to trust them and to take their guidance. And so there's a lot of trust that resulted in positive marks.
Some of the lyrics on this album are really striking, particularly at the start of Old Fear of Father.
I love my boys more than I love my girl. Try not to show it. She knows like I knew.
Some of the lyrics here are speaking to the politics of our age in a way that you maybe haven't engaged with them before on other albums.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
If we're talking about Old Fear of Father or any of these subjects, they're really, really, I mean, they're tangles that have been tangling themselves since we wrote down history.
Yeah.
But I like to write about things that kind of weasel their way into my brain and form an obsession. And one thing that I find very curious is misogyny as it's perpetuated by a female, because it is, not always, but it takes two to tango. There's definitely a place within this dysfunction that females participate in. And in this song, the mother is competitive with her daughter because she feels insecure at home. And this is something you see a lot. You see it with women a lot when they're competitive with each other because they feel insecure. And that's because they don't feel like they can get what they need on their own. So whenever I'm thinking we're going to be more accepting of each other, a little bit of time goes by, and then they want to take away these rights and these rights. They want to allow discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. It's more about just watching the pendulum swinging. And what's really curious about that is that I'm positive that I'm correct and how we should be treating each other and how we should share this earth. And then the other side of that is that they are positive that they're correct and that they are positive about how we should be sharing this earth. They want to, you know, take over. It's okay to take over. It's okay to take away from others. So it's strange. I can't tell them that they're wrong because according to them, I'm wrong. So, you know what I mean? I don't know how you reconcile those belief systems.
What does that mean for your songwriting when you come to kind of engage with these themes lyrically? Does it mean that you present them maybe without as much of a kind of polemic judgment?
So, no, they're all very clearly weighed.
Yeah.
And I definitely put in my vote, absolutely. It's just a curious thing, belief. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Belief has a way of forming everything. How am I correct if they're correct too?
I wanted to ask about mentorship. You famously worked with Tom Waits years ago, and I believe that he became a kind of mentor in your sort of, and with his partner became a mentor in the early stages of your career. And I wondered how having had a mentor, certainly in his case, a very kind of significant, you know, in the musical world one, whether that has, how that has kind of helps, how that set you up, and whether it's something that you're kind of engaging with as you meet musicians who are maybe earlier in their careers than you are.
I would choose the word example.
Okay.
Because I wasn't necessarily sought out to be mentored, but by way of being together all of the time, they were an example to me, and they also steered me in certain directions, like telling me I had to get something done faster than 6 months, you know, to finish my one song. You know. Anyhow, yeah, I find myself reflecting upon that quite a bit, actually, because I think I'm the same age now as they were when I met them. It was a long time ago. It was two lifetimes ago. And I have people who work with me now. Sometimes we have interns. I have really young players who work with me. Not that they would be looking up to me in the same way, but in the way that I have these years of experience and knowing what it was like to look up to someone else and praying that I impart good advice and also in earnest. And there's not much I want to do in life in earnest, but one thing I do want to do in earnest is pass on solid, good advice and help people chart their course if I can.
Just finally, you mentioned just there that it was two lifetimes ago that you met Tom Waits.
Yeah.
I wondered what your albums mean to you in the context of the passing of time. Do they serve as markers? Are they points at which you stop and you, I mean, I'm sure you're writing constantly, but when you bring together what you've written into a single kind of unit, is that a moment when you're looking back, you're reflecting on what's happened since the last album came out, or on how you've grown since the last album came out, or are you looking to the future, or is it just a reflection on the present?
Probably the latter, because I have the very practical requirement of writing this many songs in this amount of time. And so it's like baking bread. You know, you have to put bread on the table, so you bake it. It's like that. And I'm not always writing. I write in seasons. So when it's time to be on the stage, I'm not really writing. I can't do them at the same time. It's about cycles and seasons, and it's all very... Not that there isn't this romance to it. There is a romance in the way that I get to go off in these settings and muse and make music, which is a beautiful thing. So that is all kind of wrapped by a structure of need.
I've been going through something quietly, so quietly.
Jessica Hoop there speaking to Augustine Macellari, and Jessica's new album, Stone Child, is out on the 5th of July this week.
And now let's have a listen to another one from it. This is Red, White and Black. Red, White and Black there by Jessica Hoop, and that's from her new album, Stone Child, which is out this week. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Download the free Monocle 24 app today to tune in wherever in the world you happen to be. Whether you're catching up on the news on your daily commute, enjoying a little cultural nourishment during your morning run, or seeking some recipe inspiration around the kitchen table, the Monocle 24 app allows you to tune in live or download your favourite shows to enjoy later. Get started by downloading the Monocle 24 app today. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Get ready to take a tour of the most vibrant, thriving and altogether lovable cities around the world in Monocle's bumper July-August issue. First up, our annual quality of life survey ranks the top 25 most livable cities from Amsterdam to Zurich. We have a new winner this year. How did your city rank? Onto the business section, where we take a look at the best locations to set up shop. As our visits to Porto, Thessaloniki and Bari show, you needn't pay more to live better. Then we prime you for a cultured holiday with our Summer 100, an essential list of galleries to go to, books to buy, cinemas worth seeing and tunes to tune into as the temperatures spike. On the design pages, we get playful in our report on the importance of parks, whereas our inventory is dedicated to six urban waterway-focused itineraries. Finally, we sit down with Pierre Hardy, Hermès Creative Director of Footwear, to ask whether we've reached peak sneaker. Monocle's July-August issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
Canadian artist Brian Youngen's work has ranged from sculpture to installations, which often playfully deconstruct objects from the everyday and focus on First Nations and Native American heritage.
For example, his latest exhibition at the Art Gallery of Ontario, Friendship Centre, features works such as Warrior One. For the piece, he carved up a pair of Nike trainers into feather-like pieces to resemble Cheyenne-style war bonnets.
Monocle's Will Kitchens went to the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto to learn more.
It's a pretty big exhibition. It's in their largest exhibition space at the AGO. And I've been working with curator Kitty Scott and the AGO team for over a year on this project. It's largely a survey show of existing artwork. There's a few new pieces, including the namesake for the show, Friendship Center, which is a basketball court that is based on drawings that I provided and the AGO realized into a full-size basketball court in the main gallery space.
And the basketball court and the gymnasium, they've both been pretty consistent themes throughout your career as an artist. Why?
Yeah, on my initial visits to the AGO, I had a chance to walk through the gallery spaces that I was going to be in, and I remarked to Kitty how they appeared like basketball or gymnasiums from schools, like most people would experience from their past, so that they lent themselves really architecturally into those type of environments. And that got me thinking about community centers and friendship centers across Canada. Friendship centers are largely for Indigenous folks that were created across the country in the 50s, as there was a large kind of movement of First Nations folks off reserves and into urban cities. So I've always kind of liked their presence and their history and what they function for in Canada. So I wanted to do this as kind of a tribute to that type of space.
And tell me about your beginnings as an artist. Can you identify a certain moment or time when sort of that seed of wanting to become an artist was first planted?
Yeah, I mean, I was always interested in art as a little kid. I was one of those kids that just kind of like sat around and drew on everything, and I was kind of like in my own world that I created, and I think my family recognized that and they were very encouraging. I was less so. I really thought that being an artist was like something that you were bound to be, you know, starving or insane, so I kind of like resisted it for a long time, and eventually I went to art school right out of high school. So
And let's jump back to the 1990s when you were working on Prototype for New Understanding. You were deconstructing sneakers and you were reassembling them to resemble First Nations masks. How did that start and sort of what was your motivation behind the project then?
Yeah, I mean, that's the work that kind of put me on the map. I first started, I guess, noticing that I was wanting to talk about my Indigenous identity in a kind of more abstract way, let's say, but also I wanted to talk about just general Indigenous identity in the country and how a lot of people perceive First Nations people and First Nations artwork. At the time, around in the late 90s, I was spending a lot of time in New York City, and I kind of happened upon a exhibit at a Nike Town store, and they were showing all of their prototype sneakers in display cases, like museum specimens. And so I was also, like earlier on that day, I was at the Museum of Natural History and looking at their collection of historic artwork from Canada, Indigenous artwork. And I kind of made connections between the way these objects are displayed in museums, and also how they're both have become these kind of commodities. So I decided to try to work with these materials and merge these two different separate ideas. So yeah, that's kind of where that started. I'd never really made objects before, so it was a real challenge.
And while your career has obviously shifted over the years, you've made quite a consistent thread of working with found objects. Why has that method of making always appealed to you?
Oh, I think there's many reasons. I've stated in the past that I've seen how my indigenous family kind of reuses and adapts materials and objects to other uses. And I think that's largely an economic reality for a lot of people, just that kind of ingenuity. And also, I look at stuff in a different way than most people. I think I look at how things come apart and how they fail in some ways, including objects and stuff that I see, like in Canadian Tire or whatever. And there's somewhat of a liberating aspect to when something is broken. Unfortunately, most people just throw stuff away, but I see something like a possibility. So there is, like, I kept seeing broken plastic patio stacking chairs. Like, as soon as a leg would break, they're impossible to fix, so people just chuck them out. So, but I thought they became this completely different form as soon as their use value was kind of removed from them.
And you mentioned how you were visiting the Museum of Natural History, and you were observing how First Nations art had really been commodified and how it was being displayed. Institutions like galleries and museums, they've long functioned as, I guess, prongs of colonization. Are we starting to see a change there? Are these institutions starting to be really better about how they deal with First Nations art and how they display it?
I kind of got carried away with that. Like, I made three of them. But it was very exciting to work on that scale. And I also really enjoyed making them on site. So I would be invited to have an exhibit, typically at a public gallery, around that time. So I would just go and I would find those chairs, because they're available globally, and I would just make a new one on site. So that was a kind of way of working that I adapted with that type of material.
So. And you mentioned how you were visiting the Museum of Natural History, and you were observing how First Nations art had really been commodified and how it was being displayed. Institutions like galleries and museums, they've long functioned as, I guess, prongs of colonization. Are we starting to see a change there? Are these institutions starting to be really better about how they deal with First Nations art and how they display it?
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing a change, and we're seeing more, not only traditional and historical Indigenous art in fine art museums, where it should be, rather than in science museums. But we're seeing a lot more focus, especially in Canada, on Indigenous art. It's maybe a different story in the U.S. Down in the States, they have a kind of, in quotes, Indian art market that's very, very separate from contemporary art. We don't really have that here. The closest thing we might have is the Inuit art history and market, but it's unique in Canada that we do have more involvement between the contemporary art dialogue and Indigenous artists.
And your career's had a pretty consistent fascination with sport. Are you a big sports fan?
Everyone thinks that I'm this sports nut. And I do pay attention. I mean, I enjoy watching sports, but I vastly prefer live sports. I do watch televised sports, but I like how professional sports kind of function as a role of this kind of collective ceremony for society. And I think that's very, very deep-rooted in humanity. And so I liked how there's that unifyingness. And I see how that works on a much smaller scale with when I go to, like, powwows or gatherings, Indigenous gatherings, and I see how these different nations, like, celebrate and have their own language with sport and dance. So it's much more blurred, I think, in Indigenous culture. There's, like, if you go to, like, Northern Games or whatever up in Northern Canada, you see how things like dance and these unique, very unique sports that they've created are very closely linked.
And finally, what do you want visitors to feel at the exhibit? Is there anything that you're hoping for people to take away?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm always interested in how people interpret my artwork, but I was giving a tour to some Indigenous youth at the AGO the other day, and I remember being their age and how I didn't know how to behave in an art museum. I was very intimidated by it. And I think I want my exhibition to be more welcoming. And I want all sorts of people, but especially youth who really connect with the work I made with Air Jordans, I want them to feel comfortable and kind of a bit more free in the space. So, yeah, I don't know, hopefully that would be a takeaway.
Brian Young, and they're speaking to Will Kitchens in Toronto. And Brian's show, Friendship Centre, is at the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto until the end of August. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
We've been thinking a lot about food at Monocle, particularly as we applied the finishing touches to our brand new drinking and dining directory, which is on newsstands now. Within the magazine's 200-odd glossy pages, we've surveyed our 50 favourite places to eat in our restaurant awards, plus dispatched hungry reporters in six continents. They came back with food scoops from the quirky, think iceberg cowboys in Newfoundland, to the thoughtful, cue the food folk looking to revive the Algarve's package holiday image, with something tastier. All before plans of relocating to Ojai in California, plus a survey of Vienna's city vineyards and mulling over how to host at home. Oh, and did we mention the 30-plus recipes we've laid on? Ours is an opportunity-orientated glimpse at the world of food, where restaurateurs, bakers and distillers done good offer us their tips for jacking in the day job and starting a food-focused endeavour. We also hone in on the markets and department stores that are reviving brick-and-mortar retail, and in which battalions of smaller producers are creating better products, plus doing so transparently and with a lot less waste. For all that and more, you can buy Monocle's Drinking and Dining Directory, and we suggest you should. It's on newsstands, or you can subscribe at monocle.com today.
Immerse yourself in the world of Monocle. Visit monocle.com. Listen live to our radio station, Monocle 24, or explore more than 5,000 hours of audio. Every minute of every show we've broadcast since we launched. And don't forget that we have over 400 films to watch and share, while magazine subscribers can log in and browse our complete print archive on screen. Our online shop is here too, which you'll find well stocked with clothing, books, travel accessories, fragrances, homewares, and more. Check into monocle.com every day for fresh news and opinion from our editors and bureau around the globe. Then plan a trip to one of those spots for business or pleasure with our handy city and resort guides. It's all there for you at monocle.com. What are you waiting for?
What do we really do all day? It's a question I often ask of Fernando's work ethic. But two people who've been giving the topic a lot more intelligent thought are Professors Jonathan Gershuni and Oriol Sullivan.
The two are specialists in the fields of economic sociology and sociology of gender at University College London, and they're also the minds behind the wonderfully titled department, the Centre for Time Use Research at UCL. They've just published a new book, What We Really Do All Day, and they join us now to tell some of their findings. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Oriol and Jonathan. Tell us a bit more about the Centre for Time Use Research. Where did it all begin?
Well, I think I should let Jay answer that as the originator.
I started collecting this data, I have to say, in the later 1970s for various reasons, basically to try to understand this process whereby economic activity got spun out of the economy and into the household. And you'd had these processes whereby people, instead of buying tickets on public transport, bought their own motor cars. Instead of going to the cinema, bought televisions. Instead of going to laundries, bought washing machines. I was interested in that process and I started collecting this data. I think I first met Oriol in Essex University in the 1990s and we started to work together. The Centre for Time Use Research actually only started after I'd moved to Oxford University in the early part of this century, and Oriol joined us about 2010, and we've been an ESRC Economic and Social Research Council designated research centre since 2014.
So we're a mix of sociologists, economists, demographers, and we do research on gender, family structures, different kinds of, well, all the things we've been talking about, information technology, health, well-being, a whole range of different areas that it's possible to address using this particular kind of data.
How was the research process? I mean, how did you really find what people do all day?
So our research is based on a large nationally representative sample of time use diaries in which we ask people to complete. So we have this idea of diaries which we complete subjectively ourselves, and we write down our perhaps lists of emotions and things. But this particular diary is based on activity. So we ask people to record through the day what they do every 10 minutes so that we end up with a complete record, a 24-hour, and in this case a two-day record, 48-hour record over a weekday and a weekend of everything that people do through the day, plus who they're doing it with, where they're doing it, and how much they're enjoying it.
We've been collecting this information for several decades, and in fact, before we started collecting that information, we were actually lucky enough to find that other people had been collecting it for us. So the BBC Audience Research Department actually collected diaries of this sort going back to the 1930s, and we were able to reconstruct those diaries from 1961 onwards, which gives us a more than 50 years of history of exactly this sort. Yeah. Maybe the right way to think of it is the exact opposite of what journalists often do, which is a vox pop. You find Mr. Jones of Cheam and you ask him what he's done. Well, this is Mr. Average UK, and it gives you across all 60 million plus of those Mr. Jones, it gives you the average for the population in that year, the average time they spend washing or sleeping or doing housework or doing their jobs.
And Oriol, I have a question for you. I mean, let's talk about some of the findings. One that is quite surprising is the fact that we sleep more. Because, you know, I kind of had this idea that perhaps we're sleeping less and less because we, you know, there's technology everywhere, there's so many things that we're doing. But actually, it's the opposite. Was that surprising for you?
It is a surprising finding, yes. I think we expect, because of all the media interest in 24-hour society and, as you say, the rise of technological devices that mean we might be spending a lot more time where we might have been sleeping, we're actually now on our computers. But in fact, when you look again, and this is the overall average, of course, you see that people are, there doesn't seem to be very much change over a 50-year period in the amount of time that we're spending in bed or spending in bed resting, sleeping, resting activities in bed. So it rather goes against that whole idea that life is speeding up and we're all feeling much more rushed and we're getting less sleep and we're doing more things. And we don't really find that in the book. It's one of the surprising results from it.
If I may follow up as well with you, Jonathan, do you think, are we having more pleasant days compared to the past? What do you think? Sorry, I know this is not a very, is a difficult question.
Well, it's actually a question that we're very interested in. And unfortunately, we've only got this information about how much people enjoy their time for the most recent survey, for the 2015 survey. What we can do, though, is identify the sorts of things that people do enjoy. We do know that those relative enjoyment of eating out, watching television, doing the washing up, the relativities of that are pretty stable over time. And what we can see is that there's been a small increase in doing some of the more pleasant activities, small increase in leisure time, though much smaller than people expected over historical time. And the small increase in sleep, I have to say, because sleep turns out to be almost the most enjoyed activity.
How much of an insight into societies can you kind of gather from looking at how people spend their days?
Well, you can certainly see, for example, in my own specialist area, which is in gender, you can see very clear differences in paid and unpaid work times for men and women. And you can also observe clear trends in those work times. So there are groups of countries with perhaps more gender traditional ideologies where men do much less housework and childcare, whereas women do substantially more than in the UK, for example. We also observe historical trends such that in certain countries, you see where women are increasingly entering the paid labour market, have been entering the paid labour market over the last 50 years, you see that they're doing much less unpaid work, which rather begs the question, who is doing the unpaid work? But among other more gender traditional countries, that decline is not so evident yet, though there are signs of perhaps some catching up among men in more gender traditional societies, particularly of Southern Europe, the Mediterranean countries, in Spain and Italy, for example. You do see that men are actually starting now to pull more weight, and their figures are now starting to look a bit more similar to those of the liberal Anglo countries of UK and US and the continental European countries.
Those finds are extremely useful, I would say, when you look, for example, at a government. Have you guys tried to work together with the UK government, you know, about the findings and how this could affect, you know, people in general?
Yeah, we're actually collaborating very actively with the Office of National Statistics in the UK, where we have got some clues about how the shape of the economy changes. Mm. In particular, we've got very good evidence about how people use information technology and the web as software in general. And this is something that's not very well observed in conventional economic statistics. Gross national product doesn't really take account of the use that IT, information technology and various sorts of software is put to in supplying people's wants and in making people feel happier, their impact on welfare. And what we're doing is trying to help the ONS to develop statistics that better reflect the real sources of changes in well-being over historical time.
One example of that is the way in which unpaid work has been brought into the calculations. And, you know, we've shown that when you put a value on unpaid work, when you actually cost it up, it actually accounts for something like 25 or a quarter of entire gross domestic product. So that's a very valuable addition to a government's data provision, is to know exactly what the value of unpaid work is. And similarly with the enjoyment. So overall enjoyment, you can total it up in the way that we've described from all the individual diaries into a kind of aggregate measure of national well-being. And clearly that's something that then can be put alongside measures, economic conventional measures such as gross national product and gross domestic product.
That's really interesting as well to think about the kind of shift. You know, if we take cooking, for example, which is maybe up until the 90s or 2000s been definitely considered a chore, but which has kind of suddenly had this second wind as England has discovered its palate, so to speak, and there's been this ascendance in interest in food. How do you then start mapping the transition of something which would traditionally have been considered unpaid labour into, you know, a hobby or leisure?
That's a really difficult question. The very best that we can do is look at the information that we have about how people view the different activities that they've got. And it's going to be much easier next time we collect this data, when we collect the enjoyment data again, and then we'll have a proper basis for looking to see how that's changing. I suspect you're absolutely right that certain sorts of unpaid work are, well, they're still work, but they're enjoyed, actually, in ways that they might not have been 20 or 30 years. But this is just speculation. Mm-hmm.
And I should say that I rather disagree with some of what Jay's just said, because I think from a gender perspective, if you look at it from a gender perspective, then cooking is still very centrally something that women do. And it may be that men are starting to do more enjoyable kinds of cooking, perhaps at weekends, and that is what we see in the data. And that may well be a kind of leisure occupation. But the bulk of everyday family cooking is still done by women, and it is still regarded as a chore. So I think there's a bit of a disjunction between, you know, this idea that we're all becoming much more aware of what we're eating, and we're starting to buy more expensive cooking equipment, and we're spending a lot of money on, expensive cookbooks and cookware and watching all sorts of television programs about cookery. But actually, in terms of the time spent cooking, there isn't a lot more time spent cooking. So that's not being reflected in what we actually do in our kitchens. And I should say what women particularly do in their kitchens. And so, yes, there is this disjunction.
Mm. OK, but there is this disagreement, and the disagreement really turns on how you sum up the experiences of different people in the society. You know, and it is certainly the case that for certain sorts of people, Oriel will tell you who, cooking is still just drudgery. But there are other people in the society for whom cooking is actually a pleasurable activity. Now, how this balance changes over historical time, that's the thing that we're trying to understand. It's not just cooking. I mean, the same thing applies to paid work. My job is really fun. Mm. I really enjoy doing it. And quite a lot of people are in fun jobs now, but also lots of people are in drudge jobs still. How does this change? What the implications this are for inequality in the society, that's the sort of problem that we're trying to get round to understand.
One of the bits that I found particularly gratifying in this was the idea that actually watching telly with your family can be valuable shared family time, which I look forward to telling my mother as soon as we finish the interview. But anecdotally, you know, I remember I used to work with a guy who said that every Saturday he would watch the Ant and Dec show with his family, and he liked it because it was the one TV show he could get his whole family to sit down and watch together. Otherwise, everyone was on their smartphones, and there's this kind of atomization where people are physically present and sharing space, but without sharing time and attention. And I wondered what your reflections are on that a bit as a kind of, I mean, because that must be one of the real kind of substantive shifts that we've seen with the introduction of personal devices.
We do see that family time in the evening together has declined somewhat, which suggests that, and in fact, we can actually see that there's less family television time together in the evenings. And what seems to have happened is, as I think everyone, every family will know this, the children go off to their own bedrooms and are doing their own thing on their own devices. So the total family time hasn't actually changed very much, but that sort of engaged family time does seem to have changed. On the other hand, watching television is a social activity, and I think certainly my own parents strongly disapproved of watching television, but I think that watching television with family is actually now one of those activities that people do positively enjoy as a social activity.
Yeah. And this is a really long-term trend, actually, that the initial introduction of the new technologies into households, you know, from the 30s through to the 70s, did actually generate a whole lot of new family interaction time. And you have stories not just of families sitting round the radio, listening to, you know, before television came along, listening to the popular radio programmes on Sundays, but also actually the motor car had the same sort of effect. You know, you went on a trip and you had your children trapped on the back seat in a place that they really couldn't escape. And this is something that seems to be maybe a negative trend, and it's a bit difficult to see what's going to substitute to spin people back into interaction, to counteract, to direct personal interaction, to counteract this spinning out to indirect IT-mediated interaction.
I was reading an article recently about an island in Norway that announced its plans to liberate itself from the kind of dictatorship of time because it's just light there for 24 hours a day. And they said, you know, why can't we have coffees on the beach at 3 a.m. if we want? And I wondered what your reflections as people who are sort of so intimately engaged with the mechanics of how people use their time are on the clock and on the kind of, you know, the way that it forms society and holds us together. We're slaves to the clock.
I'm not sure that we're slaves to the clock. I mean, I know that there is this long historical argument about the introduction of clock time and the way that before that we all lived according to the agricultural seasons. I think you'd need to ask a sleep scientist about the effects of having coffee on the beach at 3 o'clock in the morning, because I suspect there would be something biological to say that actually, you know, we do have some sort of biorhythmic biological basis to our functioning. And I think, yes, to go completely time-free, well, I'd be very interested to see the results of that experiment.
Absolutely. There's a long history of research on this that doesn't involve midnight sun, involving the exact opposite. It involves burying individuals down coal mines for hundreds of days and seeing. And what comes out of this is a 26-hour day. And there's quite a lot of evidence for separate experiments of this. People cycle round to something like a 26-hour day. In fact, the length of the day is, I believe, the same length as the Martian day. And this has been used as a basis for speculation that human beings originally came from Mars.
That's fascinating.
I certainly don't buy that story, but I entirely agree with Auriel. The biorhythms are tied to the day and we can't really escape them.
That was a nice show, wasn't it, Faye?
And we find out what we do all day. I thought it was quite an interesting research that they did there. I think we should keep a diary, Og, about what we do.
Yeah, keep it next to the dream diary. I'd be quite scared to find out how many actual minutes I spend picking my nose, though.
Or the minutes we watch, like, stupid videos on the internet. I know we both like
that.
Yeah,
we're suckers for that, aren't we?
We are.
4 hours of Instagram.
I mean...
Yeah, I don't need to know that.
It relieves our stress.
Indeed.
Well, and that's all for edition 521 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was Nora Hu. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And from me, Augusto Machinari.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.